The Bain Free Radio Hour.
Hello and welcome to the Bain Free Radio Hour. This week, Griffin Barber interviews Dan Cobalt on Dragons Gone Wild, his latest entry in the hard science fiction series, The Build-A-Dragon Sequence. And later, we continue with the serialization of One Jump Ahead by Mark L. Van Name, Part 41. Hi there, I'm Griffin Barber, your host for today's edition of the Bain Free Radio Hour. Dan Cobalt is here with us today to talk about his Bain novel, Dragons Gone Wild, an exciting addition to his Build-A-Dragon sequence of novels. Hello and welcome, Dan.
Hello. Hey, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So please introduce yourself to our fans.
My name is Dan Cobalt. I write science fiction and fantasy. And as Griffin mentioned, I have this series with Bain, which is called the Build-A-Dragon Sequence. And we're today talking about the third installment, which is called Dragons Gone Wild.
Cool.
Is that enough? I mean, that's my writing life. I'm a real world scientist too. I'm a genetics researcher at a major children's hospital. And as we were just chatting before we started recording here, I'm a bow hunter too. And it's fall, it's deer hunting season. So that's very much on my mind.
Yeah, for sure. So hardest question first, what is the coolest aspect of Dragons Gone Wild for you?
Coolest aspect. I mean, I think it's a tie because, you know, if you look at the cover, you can see a plague of locusts, which I had a lot of fun with that stuff. The whole, you know, going back to the Bible, it turns out well before the Bible, the times of the Bible, there were hordes of locusts. And I had a lot of fun looking into the science and the history behind that. But beyond that, I also really enjoyed some of the globetrotting aspects, like they end up in Australia where just the wildlife in Australia is so crazy. So many things that can kill you or make your life very difficult. And I just love writing that part.
For sure. That's one of the things that kind of always springs to mind for me is there are literally how many venomous serpents and just so many different things that will.
It's a dangerous place. That's why we used to send the criminals there.
And ruin your day, right? So did you stumble on that aspect or did you work your way to it or did the characters kind of dictate the world spanning thing? Because for the first two, we've basically been in and around the headquarters of Bad Bad Company. There we go.
Bad Company.
So now we've got the globetrotting stuff. Did you have to kind of, you figure, hey, you know what? I want to get out of town for a bit or.
I mean, I think it was the successful fruition of chasing this idea of what were dragons going to do in this book. Because in the first book, domesticating dragons, they were creating dragons that were going to be people's pets. And in the second book, deploying dragons, they were creating dragons that were going to be for the military. Right. And this time, and it's something I've always wanted to do, I wanted to come up with a scenario where they were trying to release dragons into the wild for a real purpose. I mean, in the real world, there would be quite many people nervous about releasing a synthetic organism into the wild. But, you know, as you'll find out in the start of this book, there are also some possible opportunities. If you had a synthetic organism that you could completely control its design and behavior, it could be useful to solve some ecological problems that we have, especially with like invasive species. So
Kudzu comes to
when
mind.
Writing that, yeah.
Kudzu comes to mind living in the Southeast United States, kudzu killer.
Right, I know. And we have them here in the US, right? But there are lots of there are famous examples of invasive species that are all over the place. And it seemed like a good environment to take my characters to places where I love to go or would always have always wanted to go, but haven't gone. And so that it just seemed like too good of an opportunity to send them to those places.
So how did you come to write the Build a Dragon sequence? How was the experience? What brought it to your mind or where was the genesis of the idea?
I think that the genesis was that it was inspired a little bit by my real world day job, right? I work in genetics and that's a field that's been rapidly changing. I was talking with some of my fellow hard sci-fi authors about how much that field has evolved, especially in the past 10 or 20 years. And so that's what I spend a lot of my time thinking about is genetics and genomics, and of course pushing the frontiers of that are things like gene therapy and genetic engineering. And so I spend a lot of my time thinking about that. At the same time, I'm a science fiction author, right? So my mind is always trying to turn things into interesting stories. And I just happen to love dragons, right? That's just like my area of fascination. It's something I've always loved. Almost every book I've written has some kind of dragon in it. And so it was just an opportunity to bring this together. Like, what if we could use the latest in genetic engineering tools and make dragons that would serve a purpose for us? Wouldn't that be cool, right? So that was the original genesis of the idea. And in the start of the series, the reason they do that is that an epidemic has wiped out most of the canine population. So we don't have dogs. And dogs serve a lot of purposes in our society, in the modern world. And if they suddenly were gone, that's a lot of unfilled roles. So I thought it was a good opportunity for dragons to exist. But early on, it was funny. Before we came up with this idea of the canine epidemic, I was talking with some people about this idea I had for a book where it's like, yeah, they're going to design dragons, to do certain things. And then somebody said, but why? Why would they do that? And I told them, I don't understand the question. Like, why wouldn't, if you could design dragons, why wouldn't you make dragons?
Right.
Right?
No, but I did like that in the first one, especially the customer service stuff. The customer service calls were hilarious.
Oh, yeah. I love that stuff too. It's kind of like a touch of the real world and the dry humor of that. And I have so much fun with those little interludes, like a little break where it's just like the transcript of a customer who's having a problem with their dragon calling into the company and trying to get help. I love that stuff too. And I know you enjoyed those parts. And I have
Yeah,
just as much fun
well,
writing as
and part
writing
of
them.
the thing that kind of drove it that for me was the police dog one was the one I found the most hilarious because the police dragon and the spouse of the deceased police officer who ran the dragons, not
Oh,
understanding what was going on.
it's so great. Yeah. I
No,
like
I.
the one where the cats start to go missing in the neighborhood. They're trying to figure out why and what's going on. I love that.
Yeah, for sure. No, and that having worked in customer service, oh yeah.
Yeah, anybody that's right, you know what that's like, right? Anybody that works in any field of customer service, you just get these people and you get the craziest stuff come to you in what would otherwise seem like a pretty mundane customer service job. So, I mean, it's real. Some of those things are like loosely adapted from real conversations I've had. It's very true.
So, which character in Dragon's Gone Wild kind of surprised you?
Surprise me, huh? I think, probably for this one, there's a character who I brought in who's new. His name is Dave, and he's like our main character's professional rival. They were in school together. They were in the same lab. They were sort of, I mean, they were friends, but they were also competitors, and it adds an interesting dynamic to the relationship. And coming from a science background and having people who are like my friendly competitors in the field. I mean, a lot of fields in science, especially because of all the niche specialization, a lot of these are actually small fields, right? Most people know a lot of the people that do the exact same work, and we review each other's papers and grants, and
Educated
we
by the
trading
same
people
people.
between labs, right? So having his rival, show up in something of a position of power, I think was a lot of fun. And then just kind of seeing where that went. That was the most surprising thing, because I was like, we're going to bring this guy in. I wasn't really sure where it was going to go. As probably all the people in Bane will lament to you, I always like give them a nice, tidy proposal of what I'm going to write for the book. And then I really am not good at following that at all. And so it's this sort of like, all right, Dan, we're just summarizing the book. We can just use that proposal you gave us last year, right? And I'm like, oh, bad news, guys. Totally, it went totally different. So,
Right. Nobody else ever does that.
good, good. Yeah, I mean, I figured I could be an outlier in that regard, but I mean, I'm just one of those writers, politely called discovery writers, more often called pantsers, where I'm in it and it starts going this way and I know I'm supposed to go this way and I just can't help it. I got to go this way. So
So did how did that particular character come to be? Just based on your experience, you're like, I gotta get one of my rivals or these
I
rivals
mean,
I've watched.
I have real world experience and have had similar relationships with people in the past. I've actually worked with multiple people named Dave, and I'm slightly worried they're going to think that the character is based on that, and it's not. But it's just, it's Dave is one of those guys who's like a rival, but you can't really, it's hard to dislike the guy because he's good in part because he's really good with people, which we've established our main character is not always that way, right? And so it's what some people would call soft skill, right? And it's very hard to learn. And so, everybody has weaknesses. Our main character's strength is the science, and his weakness is work dealing with the people all the time, right? So bringing somebody who's also good in science and also really good with people, that's like a pretty capable rival. And I thought that would be a very interesting thing to set up. And it definitely has had, probably there are people thinking like, oh my God, I work with Dan. This is exactly like him,
Right.
the person that's good at science and bad at people thing, but hopefully not.
Everybody wants to see the author in the work, right?
Hey, and that's okay.
So, Dragons Gone Wild deals with some great places with amazing biology and views. Was there any trepidation in writing these places into Dragons Gone Wild, or was it pure fun? Any visits to Australia or maybe the South Pole?
I mean, the place I wish I could go and I had to do a lot of research on and haven't been to is Antarctica, because it's hard to get there, and it's without a good reason, like a scientific expedition, it's very difficult for the average person to go. So, but I also want to get that right. So like that ended up being probably the most significant research into this, because there Antarctica is like the greatest unexplored frontier for us, other than perhaps like deep oceans. There's just a lot of that continent that remains pretty inaccessible, and it's one of the in the golden age of exploration, that was like one of the big frontiers. And so that was an area, but I've also, like I said, I haven't been there, so I had to go deep and find out like, well, what's it like? Like, how do you even get to an accessible place in Antarctica, and it, let's say you figure out you're going to go to this base, and which station are you going to go to and visit? What's it like? I mean, are you taking a boat there? Are you taking a plane there? And how risky is it to make that voyage and stuff? So, I mean, I did a lot of research into that and found great like firsthand accounts of people that had done it and video footage and things. It was really fun for me. I mean, looks really cold, I got to be honest. Looks pretty cold there. But I that was the so it wasn't so much trepidation as I want to make sure I got it right. So that was the biggest pre-writing research aspect that I had to spend on this.
Very cool. So Australia, have you been?
Oh, I have not, but I know a ton of Australians, and I mean, I'm pretty familiar with that area just because, I mean, who doesn't love Australia and hearing about all its crazy wildlife and stuff, and watch the Australian wildlife shows and animal plant and stuff. Like, they're always down there because that's where all the cool wildlife is, right? So, but I know a lot about it because of their great national park system that they have in Australia, and so that's where a lot of our characters spend their time running around, and that was also really fun for me. Very interesting marriage of, history and extremely unique ecology as well.
Right, for sure. That was I still can't remember his name. I really like your character that is the media star, who reminds me
Oh
of
yeah,
the
you mean Tom? Yeah,
yeah,
he's kind
Tom.
of like a media star and like a host who hosts Animal Planet or something like that.
Right, exactly.
And that's his, but he works for the Bilderbergen Dragon Company, and he
I
is like the wildlife consultant who goes with Noah, the main character, on some of their deployments. And I like that guy too. And he's another favorite character of mine. And it's also cool because not only is our main character kind of in awe of him, but he's a celebrity, right? So people react differently when he comes around, and it proves very, very useful sometimes in this book. I mean, it's useful that people who can get access and ask strangers for help and those sorts of things.
Right.
And so that's the role that Tom plays. I love that stuff too.
Yeah, well, I just
Or like
kept
a
expecting him to
CEO
say,
character or something like that. I mean, wouldn't you love to meet one of those guys in real life and go with them into the wild? I sure would.
yeah, I kept expecting him to say, "Crikey."
Well, it's funny you say it because you were helping me with a lot of my Australian slang, right? And also some of my Spanish slang. So we had fun working on some of the language aspects of it too.
Oh, for sure. So what inspired him, that particular character?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, his name, he's actually a name for a real world herpetologist who, when I was a kid, was like the state herpetologist in Missouri. I didn't meet him, but I was super into reptiles and amphibians. Big surprise, right? When I was a kid, and I used to collect them, and I had all these posters on my walls of like the Missouri native species so that I could identify anything I might catch. And they were all created by this state herpetologist. He was like the consultant on them. And so that always, when I was like, we need a herpetologist, it always stuck in my head that I'm going to use this name. And
Very cool.
you know, famously, anybody who knows me when I was a kid can tell you, I was very much into reptiles. I infamously lost not one, but two snakes in my house that were found, both of them found by my mom.
Oh,
So
cool.
I got in big trouble for that when I was a kid. So I was definitely into the reptiles. And yeah, I mean, that was where the name came from. But we've already said, like, he's the epitome of like a Crocodile Dundee style wildlife guy who, in his pseudo retired years, is looking for more steady employment, but still has a lot of the same adventures, certainly the same knowledge, and wants a little bit of the same adventures he had when he was doing his Animal Planet type thing.
Cool. Yeah, my speaking of snakes in the house, when we were living in Canada, my brother picked up a snake and brought it home, and it kept biting him, and he's like, "Oh, mom, the snake keeps biting me."
Oh,
So
God.
my mother, in a panic, we just moved there. My mother, in a panic, and she grew up in Missouri where there are lots of venomous
Yep.
snakes. She goes running down to the Mountie who's riding by. It says, "What the hell? Are there any snakes here?" And he's like, "No, but you tell your son not to pick up any snakes. That's pretty stupid." So, yeah,
Oh, that's good.
there's some interesting stuff there. And then I don't know if I told you this or not, but one of my lieutenants was is still remains a top reptile photographer.
Oh, no, I didn't know
yeah,
that, but
he
you're gonna have to
he's.
send me some of his photos. That's very
Yeah, he
cool.
takes all sorts of shots for all sorts of stuff. He's won awards, everything else like that. Yeah, he was a sniper for this for the police department that I worked at,
Oh,
and became a
okay. And then
lieutenant.
it's a different kind of sniping, I
I
guess.
guess so. Yeah, so different kind of snipe hunt. But he'd go down to South America all the time, and
Oh.
into the wilds there, and just basically baiting and taking photos of these animals in their environment. It's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, in the you know, there's a period, the golden era of like zoos in the US when they were paying people like professional collectors to go to these exotic places and collect animals for zoo collections. That must have been a very fascinating time. And there used to be some, I read these books when I was a kid. It was about this family, which that was their job, was to go get exotic animals at all these different destinations. And I love those books. It was kind of the same principle. Like each one, they were going to some awesome locale, meeting all the wildlife, trying, and they had a list of like the things they had to catch for the zoo clients back home. So I'm really into that sort of stuff too.
Very cool. It was a different world
Yeah.
for sure. So which character would you want as an ally? Would it be Tom, or would it be your someone else?
I mean, I think I like having them all as allies. I mean, I think Tom is probably the most interesting guy to be traveling with, in part because he gets recognized all the time. And he just has a very interesting life story and is just a very good, very cool, humble guy who's very chill about the fact that most people know who he is. and is very low key about it, which I love. But as far as like day to day interaction, my favorite character is Wong, who's like this Chinese born genetic engineer who works with Noah and like crazy smart and hilarious personality, and he's just like always around and always a source of antics and entertainment.
And
And
energy drinks,
yeah,
emptied energy
I mean
drinks. Yeah.
he's quirky, right? I mean, but that's sort of what it takes to be good in this job in some ways. And I've certainly worked with people like that in the past who I'm just like love seeing certain people every day, and just like working next to them or near them and running into them was always a highlight for me. And so I'm like, we got to have somebody like this in the book.
That works out pretty well. So the events of Dragons Gone Wild depends kind of heavily on geography and ecology. I had a lot of the senses you'd walked a lot of the ground that you portrayed. Any recommendations on where to go and what to see?
Yeah. Hey, if you can go to Antarctica, I highly encourage people to do it. I haven't done it yet, but I think that would be a super cool place to visit. But I mean, if you're a wildlife nut, I think a lot of people really want to go to Australia. I certainly do, while you can, and while though it's still a pretty wild place. But honestly, even though they don't spend as much time there, I love the American Southwest. Such a great environment, wonderful scenery. So if you want to stay inside our borders and try and visit cool places, I just think you could spend multiple vacations visiting the American West and the American Southwest and doing whatever you want to do, right?
For sure. So, the any specific like parks or anything like that in the Southwest or?
I mean, it really depends on if you're afraid of heights or not afraid of heights, but I hear a lot of people talk about Angel's Landing, and they're just some, and of course there's Yellowstone. It's kind of right now it's hard to get into some national parks, but I'm a fan of like ancient rock formations, so I really like areas around the Grand Canyon and the Red Rocks and those areas. Really cool places. You have to be able to tolerate the heat, and like I said, sometimes heights, which is not for everybody.
No,
And
it
for
is
me, like as
definitely.
I get older, I'm a little more leery of like very high, being high up and like nervous about it and being like, well, I have to be sensible. But at the same time, it's like, ooh, that's a long way down. So.
Yeah, I never really, I literally never used to be afraid of heights. And then a guy running away from me ran off a 4-story top of a building.
Ooh,
And
this is on the
yes.
job, I assume. Wow.
I still
Four-story, yeah,
remember
that's
I still
worrying
remember
for
the
me. Oh God.
And then he was an idiot. He tried to get away still, and he crawled under something. We couldn't find him for another 45 minutes.
Oh gosh.
So he agonized for another 45 minutes. He did not have to. But yeah, ever since
Well, that's
that,
an illustration. Humans are not meant to fall from height. I mean,
no.
that's just illustrated that point for us very
Yeah,
nicely.
when we're chasing the buffalo off the cliff, we shouldn't be following them.
Yeah.
But yeah, so
It's amazing. I mean, humans as a as an animal, in some way, we're like way far behind so many other animals that are below us in the food chain. I mean, if you knock a bug off a table onto the floor, that's many times their height, but they're fine, right? I mean, but humans, if we fall more than like 4 feet, it's usually like injure an ankle or worse. This is terrible.
yep.
We're
And
just, in
depending on
some
your
ways, we're not
age,
very evolved, you know?
it could be it.
Yeah, really. Or just fall while walking. I mean,
Yeah.
yeah, as you get older, it gets even more dangerous just to be walking around in places. So,
For sure. So, just kind of going off the subject of Dragons Gone Wild, which I really enjoyed reading, but can you tell us a little bit about your work with kids' genomics and
yeah,
what that
I'm happy
entails?
to. A well-known secret about scientists is if you want to have a long conversation, always ask about their work, right? So I work in a major children's hospital, and specifically, I work on rare diseases, most of which are genetic when they affect children. And often they are chronic, lifelong conditions that involve specialized care for the affected patients. But we have seen an explosion in genetic testing over the past decade, in particular, which is fantastic. It's been fueled in part by an improvement in the speed of DNA sequencing. Which has really fundamentally changed our ability to study the genome and our ability to test patients. I mean, if you think about the Human Genome Project, the technology used for that, it took 10 years and about $1 billion to sequence the very first human genome to build the map. And now we can sequence a human genome in 2 days and at for about $1,000, even less than that usually. So it has changed substantially in a very short period of time. But in spite of all these improvements and the rapid growth of genetic testing, we still fail to find an answer for about 50% of patients who get testing for a suspected genetic condition. And since I'm a researcher, that's where my group comes in. We enroll these patients in studies to see if we can uncover the cause of their disease when it isn't something that was easy to find. Maybe it's a new disease gene or a new type of mutation that is difficult to detect with our current sequencing technology. So we are always looking to discover new genes, which then, if you find the gene for this new rare disease, then other labs can test for it, and it kind of gooses up the diagnostic rate across the board. And it also makes big differences for these patients and families because they're searching for answers. And in my field, we have something called the diagnostic odyssey. That's what a lot of these patients go through. It's years of invasive testing and multiple doctors and suspected diagnoses and negative tests to really get an answer. And we love finding the answers for those families because it makes such a difference for them. And sometimes it can even have a tremendous upside, like there are a growing number of rare disorders for which gene therapy trials are available, or even gene therapy treatments are becoming available. So there's a reason we need to try and diagnose as many of these kids as possible. And that's what my group does.
Very, very cool. Because yeah, the one of the Odyssey is truly it. Because so many people they end up, not knowing what's wrong, not knowing what's wrong, knowing something's wrong, but not knowing what, and being told different answers. So anything that can limit that experience, because not knowing is often as horrible is more horrible than knowing.
Yeah, and the knowledge is power too, right, for these families, because when you have a diagnosis, that empowers you. I mean, it helps you and your clinician team work out like what's the management plan for your child, but it also it lets families connect who are affected by the same condition. A lot of these they have very active family groups, support groups like Facebook groups and things to connect these families, because a lot of these things, they're individually rare. There might be one family in a city or a state that has it, but across the globe, they're more common. And so connecting those families, it often helps them deal with something that otherwise they might feel somewhat alone. And we also, we hear a lot through genetic counselors and clinicians about what the experience is for families. And I'll say that we hear that one of the most powerful things of when we find make diagnoses for patients with testing is that it can be somewhat vindicating for them, because a lot of parents in our medical systems have trouble convincing doctors that there's something wrong with their child. They know instinctively, like, something is not right. My child is not doing something that my other child was doing by now. And sometimes the doctors tell either the patient or their family, no, everything's fine. You don't need to worry about it, or it's not as bad as you think. And then empowering them by giving them a diagnosis, and they can say, they do have this thing. This is what it's called. Here's the diagnosis. It is transformative for them, because I think it helps them start those conversations and feel that they were not wrong. And also when there's a genetic cause, I mean, that's nobody's fault. Right. And it's also sometimes I think parents wonder, like, did I do something wrong? And usually that's not true. When it's a genetic disorder, it was not in your hands. It's something happened to you or your child. And I think that's another reason we like to try and find answers for these. It's just it answers the mystery. It tells them they were right to suspect something was going on. And it explains what happened, and that it wasn't anything somebody did. It's just a roll of the dice of fate of genetic interactions that cause these things sometimes.
I was interesting about the cost as opposed to what it's that looks like now. Because during the course of my 20-year career in law enforcement, it went from $1,000 for a simple DNA test on a weapon to 250, I think,
That's
270.
good.
So like it got cheaper and cheaper the more the labs got to, knowing what they were doing, et cetera.
I'm
So.
curious. I mean, since you brought it up, and it touches on my field, I think the forensic genetic genealogy stuff that's happening in law enforcement right now. I follow that, right? I mean, it's not my area of genetics, but I find it very interesting because I'm also like a closet true crime fan. And so it's impressive to me the stuff that we can now do with forensic DNA testing that was impossible before. I mean, it's really closed some pretty high profile cases that
Oh
had gone
yeah,
unsolved
the
for years
guy,
and decades.
the LA creature, or not the LA creature, the
Golden State
California.
Killer, yeah, I mean, lots of those. That was like the thing that really put him on the map. But you actually, I mean, they're solving a lot of old cold cases with this technology, which it's not all science. It's actually some of it's just like good old fashioned leather shoe work of investigation and like get some genetic clues, but you have to collect the family information
Yeah,
and talk to the people.
I had a DNA test. I had from a victim. We took the DNA from a victim, I think it was 12. No, it was later than that. It was 14 years later. The guy got popped for something else,
Oh, and they got him.
and he got convicted. So they took DNA. Now, that's the only way they can in California, as far as another exemplar. So he got nailed for this crime too. So he was coming from prison to have to deal with me testifying on a 12-year-old case. Like the first two numbers in your case number are the year. And I'm like, oh, two? What?
Whoa, wow, that's an old one.
So yeah, it was pretty wild. But very cool. It's that exact thing, right?
Yeah, I
Somebody
mean,
that
it's
thought they got away with it probably doesn't even remember doing the crime, because that's what kind of dirtbag they were. They got hammered with it.
good. You know, I love hearing when, you know, my field of scientific interest is helping other professions like yours. I mean, that's so awesome to hear because, like, obviously for us, it's like, wow, this technology is so great. We're doing so many amazing things. But then it trickles out, right, to other aspects to improve society as a whole, made your job a little bit easier, right? I mean, and I love hearing stuff like that.
Yeah, the only thing that kind of creeps me out about some of this, the privacy, stuff as well. It's like, oh man. But
Hey man, don't do the crime if you can't do the time. That's what
exactly. But the weirdness on there was because it was the I can't remember his name, but it was initials killer, because he was operating in my area in the 70s.
BTK.
BTK, yeah. The BTK guy is that, they didn't identify him through him. They identified him through his son or his nephew, I
Relatives,
think it was.
yeah.
And
That's
they.
the yeah, that's the you know thing they don't necessarily advertise as much about the genealogy is
Yeah.
it's not like the perpetrators themselves are going to get, you
Yeah,
know,
because they know.
Ancestry.com testing. It's like a relative, and then
Right.
that's how they track some of these people down. So I mean I understand your perspective on that and it's a valid conversation. And I'm gonna stay out of that debate because it's not for me to say, but
Well,
I love the fact.
it's an ongoing judicial argument, right? So,
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's one of those things that we won't all necessarily agree on, but I think if we take a step back and say, well, we can definitely say that at least right now, it's helping people that work in criminal law enforcement. I think that's great.
yeah. Oh,
I
for
mean,
sure.
it's
And
very
the
nice when
victims.
technology helps us rather than harms us, right? So,
Yeah, and the victims getting closure,
yeah, of course, right.
That kind of thing is pretty wild. In fact, I was one of my neighbors was a cop in my city in Concord, California, was first on the scene for one of those victims.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah,
We
so
shouldn't go into it
intense.
because then we'd have to slap a terrible rating on this, you know,
No, I won't.
this recording. But yeah, that like I said, I'm into true. I follow true crime, and probably you do too. It's for you, it's just crime because that's your field.
Well,
But
I'm out of it. I'm out of the trade now, so
it's yeah, but it is. There's a mystery angle to some of this stuff of unsolved, famous unsolved cases, and I think we all like a good mystery, right?
sure.
So, I've always, I'm always fascinated by like the world's great unsolved mysteries. Not necessarily like local crime, but like there's a lot of things that people are always wondering, like what happened to that or where did that person go? And I always find those sort of unresolved mysteries in the history of the world so interesting.
Maybe future novels.
Yeah, hey, well, that's what I keep saying is how many ideas can I persuade Griffin that we should try and do? And so the list just keeps growing.
Right. So, my penultimate question tonight is what, aside from its considerable raw entertainment value, do you hope readers will carry with them after reading Dragons Gone Wild?
Oh, that's a good, that's a great question. I think, of course, if they're entertained, then I've done my job. But I think that it offers a nice little escape for people, not having a good day. I hope that people just find a little bit of escape in that and get the sense of traveling to some of these very cool destinations and interacting with the wildlife. And of course, someday we might really be able to bring dragons into the world. So I'm really just what I'm doing is providing the blueprint for what we might do if we can make that happen here. So I'm just hoping people remember this for when we can actually bring dragons in. I have lots of people who are like, no, I work in genetics, and they're like, can you do this for me now? I'll take a dragon now. And I have
Right.
to say, I wish I can't do it right yet, right now.
So, what conventions can your fans hope to catch up with you at, and what other work do you have in the pipeline?
Those are both good questions. I haven't really figured out my convention schedule for next year, but I think I want to try and go to something in the Midwest and then maybe try and do like Dragon Con or Liberty Con, one of the ones where Bane has a really nice presence. And what I'm working on next, yeah, like I said, you and I are kicking around some good ideas for I want to keep writing books for Bane. I think there's perhaps more to tell in this series. I'd love to write another dragon book, of course. And Bane has a pretty wide range of stuff that you publish. So we've been talking about trying some other types of stories and see if we can interest you guys in doing something like that. So stay tuned. I mean, this is the thing we've been focusing on. It's out in December, and I hope people really like it and enjoy it. And then you and I are going to get back to work and try and write on the next thing.
For sure. All right. Well, thank you very much, Dan. I appreciate it. Do you have anything else you want to add as
No, thanks for having
last one?
me. Long time listener. Happy to be here and be part of the Radio Hour. So thanks for having me on. This is a lot of fun.
All right. Thank you.
And now, as promised, one jump ahead. John Moore is a nanotech-enhanced soldier of fortune. Lobo is an AI, a living weapons and intelligence platform of enormous destructive potential. Two very dangerous wolves in a galaxy of deadly corporate and paramilitary predators. But Moore has grown weary of the killing, and just once he'd like to finish a job without leaving a trail of blood behind him. Not going to happen. Not on a pristine planet called Makkan, where two gigantic corporations vie for control of the local jump gate and access to the riches of an undeveloped world. Dealing with a kidnapping and extortion scheme is only the beginning for Moore and Lobo as they work to stay one jump ahead.
Each day, however, his course changed within the first few clicks away from the office. I appreciated the counter-surveillance care his bodyguards were taking. From our vantage in orbit, we watched as first one and then two more of the escort vehicles pulled aside at different points along the route and idled, engines and weapons at the ready. Anyone following from the ground would have to pass them all, so surface pursuit would end up in conflict with either the last standalone trailing vehicle or a rear-facing part of the main team. I revised my opinion of Zycheck's security. The eight vehicles represented more a practical paranoia than waste. After about 40 minutes of wandering in the city, Chung's vehicle and his five remaining escorts headed northwest out of town on a highway whose scattered buildings over the course of half an hour of travel time mutated from city to suburb to widespread collections of large houses, and then finally to a forest dotted here and there with estates. Chung and his team came to a stop at one of the largest properties, a cleared rectangular chunk of land that Lobo measured at a bit over 80 acres in size. An outer rectangle of forest about 100 yards wide surrounded the land. Three roads led into it, the one on which Chung had entered, a second on the opposite side that more or less continued the path of the entry road, and a third on the left as you came onto the estate. The cleared area glowed in the weakening daylight with a pure white light from well-distributed and almost certainly redundant sets of spotlights. Lights that made sure his team's monitors missed nothing on the ground near the house. We had the location of Chung's house. But we needed a lot more data to be able to plan any kind of attack other than complete destruction of the place. I didn't consider that a viable option, both because of the attention it would attract and because, without talking to Chung, I couldn't know whether killing him would remove the bounty or only raise it. Getting more data wasn't going to be simple. The house predictably read IR neutral to Lobo, its shielding more than he could penetrate from orbit. He wasn't built for long-distance surveillance. So we needed to find another way to take a closer look. On Mackin, I'd gotten lucky. Lobo had been deployed there as a local military reserve. So he had SAT friends, and the gardeners never noticed his surveillance drone because they were amateurs, bad amateurs. We knew no SATs here, and I had great confidence that Chung's Zycheck protection team was professional enough to immediately spot and shoot down any obviously military surveillance drone. Lobo's monitors had never tracked anything larger than birds flying over the place, so Chung and Zycheck had probably paid local flight control to keep his airspace empty. I was also confident they possessed the weapons to make sure nothing flew too low over the house. On a transmission-heavy battlefield, we could try a high-altitude flyover and dust the area with our own microsensor web, its activity sure to do no more than add to the electronic din that large-scale combat created. At Chung's estate, however, I had to assume his team had tracked and identified and was actively monitoring every transmission source in the area. Any change in the broadcast activity would trigger an alarm, an investigation, and possibly an evacuation. The estate was secure against every modern electronic approach, and that, I finally realized, provided the opening we needed. I'd been thinking of this as a battle, the estate as a battlefield, where up-to-the-second data frequently played a major role in keeping you alive. But this wasn't a battle, and Chung's home wasn't a battlefield. I wanted surveillance data, not transmissions. The distinction was everything. I told Lobo to keep us with the low-orbit gear and settled into a couch to sleep. In the morning, I'd send Lobo to rejoin the SATs and continue his monitoring. While he was at it, I'd pay a visit to Strange Kitty. Chapter 14. Organic tech has delivered all of the serious progress in human augmentation. Gene therapy, growth center manipulation, vat-grown organs, you name the technique for making us better or barring death from the door a little longer, and the odds are it's organic. Nanotech petered out, at least as far as the rest of the universe was concerned. After the agro accident resulted in an entire solar system no ship had ever been able to return from. Human/hardware fusion never took off, because whatever metal or silicon could do to help a body, cells inevitably proved to be able to do better. Hardware augmentation maintained its fans, however. People who indulged in machine-based enhancement as often and as severely as their lives and budgets would permit, all in the deep belief that one day metal tech would break through the barriers of its previous failures and elevate them into immortal meat/machine gods. Their extreme-edge bioengineering counterparts rode the same rush, but on a different vehicle, pushing the limits of organic tech as they constantly altered their bodies. Queen's Bar attracted both fringes, of course, with shops where you could ride your augmentation tech of choice not only to the legal limit, but beyond. The metal and meat tech shops predictably occupied different zones in the area, each one's clients neither approving nor particularly accepting of the others.
This has been the Bane Free Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us at the heart of science fiction. Join us next week as Sean Hazlett interviews Sharon Lee on I Dare, another amazing entry in the Liegen universe. And later, we continue with Part 42 of One Jump Ahead by Mark Van Nain, Part 42. Score by Ruth Judkowitz.